Support for Jazzed About Work comes from Ohio University's online master's degree in sustainability, security, and resilience. Does your organization or community have a workable plan for when a catastrophe strikes? This 18-month online degree program will give you the skills you need to prepare for, respond to, and recover from natural disasters and other crises. Participants earn three stackable certificates in community risk and resilience, change management and leadership, and planning resilient systems, leading to a full master's degree. Students learn cutting-edge skills in sustainability assessment and entrepreneurship, sustainable agriculture, energy policy, and more. This is an exciting, growing field, and no GRE test is required to apply. For more information, follow the link in the description on this podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Jazzed About Work, where we talk about everything that might have an impact on your career. I'm your host, Bev Jones, author of Find Your Happy at Work. And today I am very happy to welcome a widely respected civil rights champion, Judge David Tatel. He's here to tell us about his extraordinary new book, Vision, A Memoir of Blindness and Justice. The book, written with his wife, Edie Tatel, is wonderfully readable. It very smoothly weaves together the story of his exceptional career as a prominent and service-driven attorney, with a description of how, because of a disease, he gradually became blind. This is a very personal story, and yet the book also talks about the nation's judiciary, about how it works and how it can be threatened when courts show little regard for the principles of judicial restraint. On top of all that, this is a dog story. And Judge Tatel says his life changed for the better almost 5 years ago when he acquired his lovely guide dog, Vixen. With her, he now has a new best friend as well as much more independence.
Judge Tatel, thank you so much for being here today. I have been so looking forward to our conversation. And I just want to say before we plunge in, I want to say for our listeners that you and I do know each other a bit because my husband and I and you and your wife, Edie, all live in the same rural community where people tend to bump into each other a lot. And in all kinds of conversations over the last few months, I've heard people talking about your new book and how it's going to be such an important and wonderful book. So I'm really pleased to get an early opportunity to talk to you about it. But it's a story that brings several threads, your life and the state of democracy. But it's not easy to describe. So I'm going to ask before we get into it, how is it that you decided to write a book and why did you write this book?
Well, first of all, Bev, let me say what a pleasure it is to be with you this morning. We've talked about this for a while, and I'm excited to have this discussion. So let me respond to your question, if it's okay, by just reading a brief paragraph or two from the book, because at the end of the book, I actually tried to explain why I wrote the book. But for your listeners' sake, to understand this excerpt I'm going to read, they'll need to know three things. One is that my wife's name is Edie, because she's in there. Number two, when I was a teenager and just beginning to see signs of dimming vision, the first evidence of that was night vision. I had trouble seeing at night. And I tell a story about how, in order to cover up my declining vision, when I'd go to the movies with my buddies, I could get to my seat okay, but once the lights turned out, if I wanted popcorn, instead of saying to one of them, gee, I can't see, would you get it? I got it on my own, but to do it, I would count the seats going out, and then when I got to the aisle, I'd count the rows, And then when I got the popcorn, I could find my way back to my seat. And the third thing I mentioned in here is voting. And that's important because in the last chapter of the book where I discuss the Supreme Court's voting rights decisions, my ultimate conclusion is that is to emphasize the importance of voting, and especially voting for presidents and other public officials who won't use the courts for political purposes. So, with that background, here is the answer to your question, Bev.
Great, thank you.
As I approached retirement, I had lots of ideas about how I might spend my newfound freedom. Writing a memoir was not among them. Even though I had had a long and exciting career, would anyone really want to read a book about a federal judge who never made it to the Supreme Court? With Vixen's help, I'd become more comfortable with my blindness, but I definitely didn't want to write a book about being blind. Also, I felt no need to write a book for my children and grandchildren. They already know me in ways that no number of pages can capture. Nevertheless, a few people, both family and friends, encouraged me to think seriously about sharing my story. "You're not just a blind person," they said, "and you're not just a federal judge. You're a federal judge who happens to be blind, and you have a beautiful guide dog to boot." They believed that my story might inspire others, and not just people living with disabilities. That made me stop and think. I spent my entire professional life, from my early days at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights to my 3 decades on the D.C. Circuit, trying to use the law to improve people's lives. If my life story might help other people, why not share it with the world? Maybe my story would challenge preconceived notions about what people with disabilities can do. Maybe it would even inspire people to attend law school and to work for civil rights. And maybe, just maybe, I could convince a few more people to vote. I decided to give it a shot. I've written thousands of legal briefs and judicial opinions. How hard could it be? Hard, it turns out. Writing this memoir has demanded far more than just putting my story on paper. Grappling with the meaning of that story has been something else entirely. When I began this book, I couldn't have imagined how much I would learn about myself. The process has truly been a revelation. It's forced me to think deeply about my career, what I've accomplished and what I haven't. It's helped me refine my views about the Supreme Court and the threat it poses to the values and institutions we hold dear. And most difficult of all, it's made me think deeply about my blindness, my decades of denial, how I adapted to life without sight, and the ways my blindness affects Edie and our lives together. My younger self, the one who counted rows in the theater, who asked that press releases not mention blindness, who deleted references to blindness from his Wikipedia page, and who waited years to get a cane and decades to get a guide dog, couldn't have dreamed of sharing this with the world.
Wow, that's lovely. And it is an example of your writing, which, by the way, is fabulous. And now I have to say, before we plunge into content here, that this is a beautifully written book. And it is, I know, the a book that was written by both you and Edie, that you, as you've done with so many projects over the years, you sat together day after day, week after week, and wrote the book. And what you have come up with is something that's very readable. It's a good story. I think it's a love story, partly because you and Edie have been such an amazing couple. But it's also, this is a career podcast, but I want to emphasize, it's also a wonderful story about how bumps in the road, no matter how big they may be, don't have to mean that you can't have a wonderful life and a very rich and important career, because you have done all of that. So the book is a good read, and I think there's a lot of fun in it as well as a lot of seriousness. Now, as we talk about this a bit, could you maybe start here and explain a bit more about your career as a lawyer and your career as a lawyer kind of working to make the world a better place? When did that all start?
It all began in the 1960s, Bev, when I was in college at the University of Michigan. I came to college prepared to become a scientist. My father was a scientist, and that's what I always thought I would be. But I was captured by the 1960s, particularly the early 60s when I was at Michigan. It was the height of the civil rights struggles in the South. And I was just fascinated with the civil rights movement and with the role of courts and lawyers. Michigan itself was kind of a hotbed of controversy. It was very exciting times, and it changed my views about what I wanted to do. I decided at that point that I really did want to be more involved than I might be as a scientist. And so I switched to political science and eventually went to law school. And, you know, my career developed pretty much from there, sort of step by step. I began in a Chicago law firm for a couple of years, and that and more turmoil in our country, the late 60s now, the urban riots and particularly led to my first civil rights job at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, and eventually to the head of that organization in Washington. And from there to the head of the Office for Civil Rights at the U.S. Department of Health, Education, and Welfare during the Carter administration. And then after that, I returned to my law firm for 15 years, and in 1994 was appointed to the D.C. Circuit by President Clinton. Each of these steps sort of followed logically. There wasn't a plan. I didn't decide back in the 60s, okay, I'm going to go to law school and end up on the D.C. Circuit. That's not what happened. Yeah. In fact, none of those particular jobs were planned. Each job led to the next job.
And that's how it often is, that people might make all kinds of great plans, but sometimes things that are even better come along and surprising turns lead to the place where you really were meant to be. Well, while you were working your way up as a civil rights lawyer and eventually becoming a very distinguished judge, you were also expanding your family and living a very rich life with travel and adventures. But at the same time, there was the issue of your sight. And as you suggested in the piece you read, while you were dealing with it, you were also didn't want to draw attention to it, and you were kind of slow to ask for help. Would you tell us how your blindness became part of your future and how you dealt with it over time?
Well, I suppose one answer to that is read the book. That's what's in the book. But the short version of that is I have what's called retinitis pigmentosa. It's an inherited retinal disease, and it progresses. It affects different people differently, but the way it affected me, and I think many people, is you first slowly lose your night vision, and then you start losing your peripheral vision, and then eventually you lose your vision if you do. Not everybody does, but that's the way it worked for me. So when I was diagnosed when I was 15 years old, although I knew for 6 or 7 years before then that something was wrong because I just couldn't see well at night. And no one knew why. But so when I was diagnosed, at age 15. I was a kid, and it was scary to be told by a doctor that, you know, I had an eye disease and that someday I might go blind. He never said I would for sure. They didn't know, but they did know it would slowly deteriorate. I didn't run around and tell everybody, hey, I have an eye disease. I didn't tell anybody that I had it. First of all, I didn't look like I had a problem. I was functioning really well. At night, there was always a problem, but nobody noticed. I could cover it up pretty well, like I did with counting the seats. And why did I do that? I think the first and most obvious reason is kids don't want to be different. You know, you want to be like your friends, and so I didn't want to be different. And number two, I think the young David Tatel was ashamed of this eye disease. I can't explain why, but I can only report that I did feel that way. And then when I got to college and law school and beginning law practice, I still could cover it up pretty effectively. I think my friends who read this book will read it and say, yeah, you know, I knew something was wrong then, but I never said anything. But my point here is that as I started to develop a profession, I suspect that I feared that a disability would work against me, that, you know, who would want to hire a lawyer who might lose his eyesight? And that was a time when there weren't any, you know, I had role models. Role models were very important in my career, Bev. And I had many really great civil rights lawyers who were my role models and mentors, and who really are largely responsible for, I think, my successful career. But I didn't have any role models who were blind. There were no blind judges. There were no blind partners in law firms that I knew of. In other words, if there had been someone like that, you know, maybe 25-year-old, 30-year-old David Tatel might have had a different reaction to all of this, because he might have seen, oh, look, you know, Judge X on the Seventh Circuit is blind. I can do that. If he can do it, I can do it. But there were none at the time. And you know, that's, if you ask me, what's the reason you wrote this book? What is the reason I wrote this book? The main reason I wrote this book, the reason that convinced me to write it, was to try to provide that, write a book that would be inspirational to blind people. I hope that blind people will read this book and be able to see what I couldn't when I was 25 years old, namely that you can succeed at the highest levels even without sight. And perhaps even more important than that, Bev, I hope sighted people will read this book. Partners in law firms, heads of corporations will read this book and also see that they can hire blind people or anybody with a disability, and that they can function maybe with some extra help at very high levels. So I want to fill the gap that existed when I was 25 years old.
Well, I think that this book will do that. I take it even further. What really first attracted it to me when I had an early chance to look at it is that this is a book about many things, but one of them is about career resilience, that as you were dealing with blindness and reluctant to ask for help, it seems, you kept finding ways. And my sense is that other people did help you. And as time went on, new ways came. When you started using your white cane, that kind of opened up new things. But when we start a difficult journey, we don't know what are the things that are going to help. We just know that it is possible for human beings to get creative and find a way. And that's what you did. I want to while we're talking about blindness, I want to jump ahead in time, and then maybe we'll get back to your time as a judge. But I want to jump ahead in time and ask you to talk about how the way you dealt with blindness and just created your life changed when kind of later in life you got a guide dog. What happened when Vixen came into your life, and how did you make the decision to take a chance on a guide dog?
Well, I didn't get a guide dog until I was 77 years old. Now that I've had the experience, I really regret not having done it decades earlier. So the progression, as you mentioned, Bev, around 1980, I finally bit the bullet and started using a white cane. There was no other way I could function. It was a very, very difficult step, but I got very, very good with my cane. And I could travel all over the country. I was practicing law then, and I didn't get any training. I did. Edie found a woman at a community center who gave me some training. But I didn't have any formal training. But I got really, really good with my cane. As I said, I traveled all over the country, airports, restaurants, hotels. I wasn't as good as a lot of other cane users. And also, as I got older, the cane became more difficult for me. Washington, the traffic is busier. There are more of these open plazas where it's hard to navigate with a cane. My mobility was a combination of using a cane on my own and also getting help from law clerks or Edie or the kids. And I spent a huge amount of time and energy planning my day to be able to move from place to place. And I was yearning for more independence. I wanted to be more independent. And I didn't think about getting a guide dog until one night, one of our grandsons, who was then 11 years old, showed up with a podcast, and he wanted me to listen. It was a podcast about how they train and use guide dogs. This grandson, Ruben, he and his brother have a dog they love. They're big dog people. And so he brought, and I listened to this, and it was a bit of an eye-opener because I had never seriously thought about getting a guide dog, because I was under the impression that to do it, you had to go live at the facility for a month to learn to use the dog, which is true. There's a dozen or so guide dog breeding and training programs in the country, and they all have very nice facilities like hotels, and you live there for a month to learn to use the dog. Well, I wasn't going to go off for a month. That wasn't going to happen with my work. But at the end of this podcast, they said, if you're too busy to come here for a month, we will consider bringing the dog to you and training you where you live. Well, I never thought about that, or never knew that was a possibility. And I mentioned it to Edie, and somewhat to my surprise, she was intrigued. She said, well, why don't we see what it's all about? Anyway, long story short, we found through friends who have guide dogs a program in Connecticut called the Fidelco Guide Dog Foundation. And this is a unique program because they don't have a facility. Their philosophy is that you're best trained where you live. So we signed up. It took a year from the moment I signed up to get the dog, because it's like applying to college. It's applications and references, and they do home visits, and it's pretty rigorous. And then it takes a long time for them to match the dog to the person, because dogs are different and people are different, and they want the team to work well. And this program in Connecticut, Fidelco, they breed and train only German Shepherds. And so one day in August, 4.5 years ago, a van with big German Shepherd pictures on it shows up at our apartment, and out hops this beautiful 2-year-old German Shepherd who has become my closest friend for the past 4.5 years. Her name is Vixen.
And she is a beauty. I'm always amazed by her because she's so responsive to you. But then when you tell her it's okay that to be off duty for a while, she's just a fun, wonderful, friendly dog who loves everybody. She's just gorgeous.
Yeah, she's a pretty special dog.
Well, I want to change gears now, although it's always hard to turn away from beautiful Vixen. But I want to talk about another part of your book. The book is Vision is a memoir of blindness and justice. That's the longer title of the book. And so let's talk a bit about justice and your time as a judge. I think that joining the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia must have been a dream job. But not everybody knows how the D.C. Circuit is different from other circuits. Would you tell us a bit about what the job entails and how it is that your years of experience there gave you a very special view of the Supreme Court?
Yes. Let me just say before I do that, the last chapter of the book is called The Dog That Changed My Life. And that's not an overstatement. It's all about Vixen and how I learned to work with her and how she's really dramatically changed not just my life, but also Edie's. So on to the court. So I was nominated by President Clinton in 1994. I was 52 years old. I was in a law firm. And I was nominated to fill the seat created by the vacancy created by Ruth Bader Ginsburg's appointment to the Supreme Court. So the D.C. Circuit is an appeals court. It's one of 11 federal appeals courts in the country. It hears, it reviews the decisions of trial courts in the district plus hundreds of federal agencies. And the decisions of the D.C. Circuit are appealable to the Supreme Court. But the Supreme Court only takes two or three, at most, cases each year from my court. The Supreme Court reviews all the circuit courts and all the state courts. So it can't, it has a limited, and it only hears 60 or 70 cases a year. So at most, it takes one or two of our cases. So for all practical purposes, the D.C. Circuit is a final court. The decisions are final. The reason it's called the nation's second most powerful court. And the reason for that is that the other circuit courts in the country are regional, and they hear cases from their regions. The D.C. Circuit is in D.C., and it hears cases from all the federal agencies. And the federal agencies, for example, the Federal Communications Commission, the Environmental Protection Agency, the Food and Drug Administration, there's 400 of them as far as I know. Their jurisdiction is national. They regulate whatever they regulate nationwide. And so the D.C. Circuit is very much a national court, just like the Supreme Court. And we could, on one day, we could be hearing one case involving Yellowstone National Park on our first case. We could have another case involving a labor dispute in Washington State, and a third case involving something from something in Tennessee. So it's a national court like the Supreme Court and unlike the other circuit courts.
And how did you get used to it? How did you make yourself the expert that you became? I think it would be very challenging to suddenly find yourself at a top court as a judge when you hadn't kind of grown up in your career thinking you were going to become a judge necessarily.
Yes, it was quite a change to go from a practicing lawyer to being a federal judge. And I would say it took a good 5 or 6 years on the court for me to begin to feel comfortable with the job. There was so much to learn about how the court functions, about the law. I mean, I knew a whole lot about civil rights law when I came to the court, but I didn't know very much about a whole lot of other things. I had had very little experience with most of the agencies we regulated. So, you know, when I get my first Federal Communications Commission case, I had a huge amount to learn about the agency and the technology involved in the case. I worked very hard at the beginning to master the work. It was very intense, but also, Bev, extremely rewarding. Every day was a learning experience. Every day was a new adventure of learning something new and working on a subject I didn't know much about and then mastering it. It was.
It sounds like it was not only the specific cases that you were immersed in, but because of where you were located, you had an incredible view of how democracy works in our system, how there's an interplay between Congress and the federal agencies and the people and the Supreme Court. And as you became more and more engaged in some of the big cases, it feels as though in recent years, you started to worry about how that balance is. It felt a little bit, when I was reading your book, that you were noticing that we were getting out of balance as a system. Is that right? And can you tell us a little bit about what your concerns were as time went on?
Yes, my concerns grew over the years about the extent to which the Supreme Court and also the lower federal courts were becoming more political and less judicial. What's happened in our country in the past 20 or 30 years is that our Congress has become increasingly dysfunctional for lots of reasons that we don't have time to go into. More and more bigger and more difficult and policy-laden disputes have ended up in the courts. So the courts are deciding many more hot-button issues that are very divisive in our country. And at the same time that that's happening, my concern is that the Supreme Court and the lower federal courts have begun to stray from their role as courts and become more policy institutions. I can just explain that very quickly. The key to an effective judicial system we have three branches of government, and they're the executive, the legislative, and the judicial. And they check each other. It's called checks and balances. It's critical to individual freedom. That was a critical factor in the way our Constitution was designed. It created a government of limited powers, and the three branches were set up to check each other. And this is all designed to protect individual freedom from government, the abuse of government power. Well, the problem in that system is that one of the branches, namely the courts, potentially have enormous power over the other two. The courts can declare laws unconstitutional that Congress passes. The courts can prohibit the executive branch from acting. And so it has enormous power over them, and it's unelected. So here we have the least democratic branch of our three-branch government, with enormous potential power over the other two. Well, why is it that the courts over the years haven't taken over the powers of the other two branches of government? The answer is the courts have restrained themselves. They've used their power carefully. They've limited their actions to their strict area of jurisdiction. They've respected the legislation Congress passes and the plain language of the Constitution. They've restrained themselves. It's called judicial restraint. And that's what's kept the courts in their lane and not stepping into the lanes of the other two. Well, in the past decade or so, those principles are fraying. And the Supreme Court especially has been departing from those rules in ways that I think are potentially quite dangerous.
That is very scary. What can we do? What can society do? Are there things that people who are not judges can do to help impact the situation?
The most important thing citizens can do is vote. And vote for candidates who will not use the courts for political purposes, who will instead of saying, I'm going to appoint judges who will overrule Roe v. Wade, judges who will say, I'm going to appoint the best judges I can find. Vote for members of Congress and the Senate and the House, who will take seriously what the court is doing. The Congress can check the courts. Congress has the power. If the decision of the court is interpreting a statute, Congress can overrule that. Congress can and has often checked the power of the federal courts. It's only when the federal court issues a constitutional decision that the powers of Congress are limited. But many of the most disturbing Supreme Court opinions, Congress could fix. And so we need to vote for members of Congress who see this, who understand the role of the courts and will take this seriously. Congress, I said a few minutes ago, is largely dysfunctional for lots of reasons. It's especially dysfunctional when it comes to the courts. It isn't exercising its constitutional authority to check the courts. Checks and balances, it isn't doing that.
So
that's why voting is so important.
Something that everybody can be more aware of, perhaps, and bring it to a congressional level, bring it to a local level, make this an issue that people care about. In some states, it's more of a problem than in other states. It feels like it is something that's going to require citizens to to think about and voice some concern.
Right, Bev. And it's not just the federal courts. In fact, most courts are state courts. There's 50 separate state court systems. And they decide most of the cases in our country. And most of those courts are actually, at least many of them, are in fact elected. So the role for citizens in state courts is just enormous. And also, even though the federal courts are less responsive today than they should be to individual rights and protecting the environment and other things like that I care about, there are the state courts, and the state courts can accomplish a lot. And so citizens need to pay attention to the justices, the judges and justices who are running in their states, and they need to vote for judges who will function like judges and take their job seriously and understand the difference between being a judge and being a member of a legislature. A good example is what just happened in Wisconsin. Wisconsin, the people of Wisconsin, by getting organized and getting involved in the election recently, completely changed their highest court, and the changes within the state are dramatic. It was all because citizens got involved and voted.
Yeah, that's an important example. Well, thank you for bringing our attention to it. I think we're just about out of time. I could talk with you for a long time, but let me say again that the name of this book is Vision, A Memoir of Blindness and Justice. And I will also say it's a love story. It's a career story. It's an inspirement story. And it's beautifully written. It's a very readable, interesting book. So I'm thrilled to have you here on this podcast. And I hope things go very well as you start getting this book around America. I think there'll be a lot of interest. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Bev. It was my pleasure to be here. I very much enjoyed our conversation.
I did too. Have a great day.
You too.
Today we've been talking with Judge David Tatel about his new book, Vision, A Memoir of Blindness and Justice. This podcast is produced by WOUB Public Media. Colin Cameron is our audio engineer. I'm your host, Beverly Jones, author of Find Your Happy at Work. And our sponsor is the Voinovich School of Leadership and Public Service at Ohio University. Today's tip is that if you're facing barriers in your career, don't give up. Sometimes the things that seem to block your progress are developments that will help you build strength and insights and eventually enjoy success. Thanks for listening, and if you enjoyed today's show, please give us a 5-star review.